Hi, everybody. It's Friday. My name is Tom Scott. RP, good to see you. Thank you for being here. I'm going to say that this week was very tiring, which that's okay. That's not a complaint, just an observation. So much going on. And one of the things that's clear to me is I really haven't had a moment. You know, there's no free time. Work, the world, just end to end, going to bed later than I used to. What amazes me, and I forget what the one, somebody just said something a moment ago, there's so much going on that I'm like, I'm up to, I know like 50% of it or less. And I'm talking about the big headlines. I can't even keep up with the big headlines. And it's pretty shocking what I see. It's also been really beautiful in a whole bunch of ways. Just in the sense that there are people taking actions that to me feel heroic and unique for my lifetime. So that's the beautiful side of it. There's so many things that are horrifying to me, but I would also say there, you know, there's been a couple of people who I know personally have said some things that have been very disappointing to me, but they're in the minority. There's other people who sort of have held a certain position politically. I mean a philosophy politically, who don't seem to have that strong of a philosophy anymore and are frankly really committed to change in a good way. That makes me feel really good. So one of the things, so you and I spoke before the show, it would be very helpful for me, RP, and I think for everybody, two things. One is I know you have some stuff put together just in terms of what's going on in the broader world, let's say the post, let's go outside COVID world, and in the COVID world. We're going to talk about both of those things. You know, we haven't spoken about COVID in about a week. And I know people somewhere in the back of their minds are thinking like, I wonder what's going to happen with this COVID thing now, which I'm guessing it's still too early to know. But I am definitely seeing behaviors that if we saw these behaviors 2 or 3 weeks ago, we would have been super anxious about it. But I'm not sure we've had time to be anxious about it. Not to mention, you know, the protests and the proximity of the people in the protests, physical proximity, and what that might do for the disease. So what if we start there, just because I think it's important, but I do want to be clear, I want to talk about George Floyd, et cetera, but I think it might be a good way to lead in, which is COVID.
Thanks, Tom. Good to see you again. Insane week for America, sad. Heroic, unbelievably historic. You know, we're going to be telling our kids and our grandkids about this week. We're going to be telling about Corona. Where were you during the great pandemic, Grandpa? And then where were you during the great George Floyd protests? My grandmother, grandfather gave me this big leather empty book with parchment in it, you know, and to put news clippings in over the years. And it's not a photo album, but for like really relevant events. And so there's a couple of headlines. And my son Reed, my 14-year-old, knows I do it. So he comes and he pulls out New York Times or whatever paper we have at the house. He's like, that should go in the book. That should go in the book. And I'm subconsciously afraid I'm going to ruin the book. There's so much stuff's going to go in there. You know, it's just such a busy time. I thought your comment about disappointing friends. People who have said things that are disappointing to us. I've been excited how few of those there's been compared to other moments of social unrest in America or other Black Lives Matter killings. I think I've said this before, but for all the, literally every other one of the killings, going back to Rodney King or the beating of Rodney King, there was at least some friends of mine, and there were certainly news organizations and commentators blaming the victim one way or the other, every instance. And I have seen none of that about George Floyd, which I think is correct and proper, obviously, but it's also a pretty positive testament about where the dialogue is going. Like, what are the little meters we can look at to see where the national dialogue is going? So that would strike me as one. The disease hasn't gone away. Let me give you a very quick update on where that is. You know, we have a whole team of outstanding analysts looking at the disease and a ton of experts we work with all week some of the best in the world. We have what's called an epidemiological curve, and I'll give you the quick update on that. We have about 105,000 dead in America right now. America is probably trending to 155 to 195,000 dead by August 1. So we've our line, you know, our predictions, if you remember any predictions that we've made previously in the last few months, this is the same curve we predicted then. There's no dramatic change. We've extended it one more month. We can't really look past August 1 and have any degree of accuracy. It gets a little too guessy. We don't know what's going to happen. I think Governor Cuomo yesterday or today said, if you've been part of the protest, you should consider yourself infected. That's probably good public health and probably a good way to be responsible to other people, particularly if you have vulnerable people in your life. I don't know that it's actually biologically correct. If it is, we're in a humongous amount of trouble. I don't think that's the reality. We have a lot of optimism about weather. We also have a lot of optimism about recent studies that show people tend to get this disease after what's called a heavier viral insult, right? So, you know, picture a friend who's a close talker, they're right up on you, and they have the disease, and you're getting spittle all over your face for a period of time. Or there's one great study about a bunch of people in a choir in a church locked in singing for hours and hours, and 3/4 of them got infected from one person. That's what they believe now is the most likely route of transmission, is persistent exposure to an infected person and a sharing of spittle. So if you think about it, if you're standing next to a fellow protester, they're as far away as, you know, my hand. If they're 3 feet away from you, which is less than 6, which is clearly what's happening in these protests, they happen to be infected and they happen to be in the transmitting stage, and you both have masks on, you're very likely to be safer. No such thing as safe. If you don't have masks on and one of them's, you know, yelling and spitting as they're protesting, which is what happens, and you get it on your face, then you are definitely exposed to it. There's a possibility that our immune system can fight off that small insult. If you don't see that person again, you have that initial insult, there's a possibility our body can fight that off. We'll see. We'll find out really soon. There are states, obviously, and that are kind of getting caught screwing around with the data. Georgia has been caught over and over screwing around with their data about the number sick. It's kind of stunning they would do that. But you can't really lie about people who are dead in hospitals. So, you know, 2 weeks from now, or probably a week from today, we'll begin to see if there's a big surge 14 days after the initial large protests, which were a week ago today. So that's a quick update on where I think things are to disease. We all care about vaccines.
Can I ask a question before you move on?
Fantastic progress. Go ahead.
So I think what I'm hearing you say, so this would be my observation, but what you just said about the choir, the chorus, et cetera, might change what I'm about to say. My general judgment based on what I thought I knew before would be that the spike is going to be very real based on behaviors I've observed, both in real life and on television. And the only reason I would say I feel any differently is just the psychological nature of they're not talking about it in the news as much. Now, if I remove that and I just go back to like, well, what are the facts here? I would say the spike's going to be worse because I feel like the behavior is worse than I expected once we went outside.
And when you by worse, you mean people are, you mean from a vaccine, from a disease transmission point of view? No.
Yeah, they're closer together. There's not as many masks as we had hoped. And I keep seeing images on the television of people in the street close together without masks. So I'm like, shit. But you also just said now they're learning that you need the intense and the close and all that. And so maybe that balances out. What do you think?
I think we don't know, but I think you raise a really good point about there's a human bias that you're referring to. Let's see if I can remember while we're talking. But you know, things that are, it's not called proximity bias, but you know, like what you see is what you believe. And so if the headlines aren't telling us about the disease, and you know, and they're telling us about the protests, then you're not thinking about the disease, so it appears that it's less of a threat. It's not, right? The disease isn't excited that we're out protesting and exercising our First Amendment rights and deciding to give us a break. That's not happening. But weather really does seem to matter. And being outside really does seem to matter. And there are not a lot of cases of people transmitting it to each other outside. In fact, one of the great epidemiologists that I spoke with recently said he hasn't found He said he hasn't found any, but that's a dangerous thing to say because there's clearly you can get it outside. So let's hope, right? We don't know, and we will find out. We just do not know. The other piece of good news, well, yeah, there could be some slight good news. If it does end up being a spike, there's two things that could be cutting in our favor. If there is a spike, if there's an increased transmission, one could be the protesters, by definition, are a little younger than folks in old folk homes. People that are over 75 have way higher fatality rate from this disease. People over 75 probably aren't doing as much protesting just by virtue of their physical activity levels, right? That could be a good thing. Now, of course, you can get infected at a protest and bring it home to your grandparents. That's a bad thing. The other other possibility of good news, again, would be being outside, UV light, you know, not the winter, worst transmission. So we'll see. So that's disease thinking. Just very quickly, vaccine work keeps going ahead. We should continue to, you know, pray for that. Keep our fingers crossed. Be optimistic. There's well over 100 trials underway. There is also going to be, you know, watch this space. There's going to be vaccine nationalism coming up where China is very, very keen to get the vaccine first. This will be the equivalent of them putting a man on the moon if they do. And it would cause a lot of consternation globally if they did. There's a lot of complication around that because they don't have enough sick people to test on in their country. So they'd have to make a deal with another country to get a lot of the phase three trials done on thousands of people. So anyway, there's a lot of competition. There's national competition to get the vaccine done. There's also national partnership. So we'll see. There's no particular breakthroughs right now, but everything is working on pace quickly. And then we kind of get to the week we just had, right, Tom?
Yeah.
We can talk more about the seas if you want. It's not going anywhere. You know, what is happening actually internationally is it's moving south. So Latin America is beginning to really catch fire. Brazil is totally in flames, unbelievably incompetent leadership, and very much resembling our own. And they're going to have hundreds of thousands dead. Chile's in trouble. Mexico's in trouble. India's doing really well. I'm just so shocked. I'm so happy, but they're doing really well. There's a theory that Southeast Asia, a lot of people there have had a vaccine before. I think it's called BCG vaccine. And it's just a vaccine that people take in regular course of their life for other things. I don't have it at the tip of my tongue. There's some possibility that may have confirmed some degree of increased immunity to this. But it's a puzzle right now why it hasn't spread more assertively through India and some other Southeast Asian countries.
Hey, before we go into the week, just let's quickly talk about Hong Kong. And it is the case that what has happened between China and Hong Kong is monumental. Right?
Monumental. Different is more than that, Tom. It's not just what happened between China and Hong Kong. In fact, how about this? What happened between China and Hong Kong is less monumental than what happened between China and the world by virtue of the way they treated Hong Kong. So if you're a Hong Konger, if you're an older Hong Konger, there's not a bad chance that they're like, hey, look, we're Chinese anyway. We're going back to China. I get it. They are making these changes. So there's an argument that a lot of the establishment people in Hong Kong are kind of not overwhelmed by what China did. Backing it up, what China did is declare the National Security Act, which is a whole series of revocations of liberties of people inside Hong Kong, a kind of ahead of the calendar and a more assertive and less freedoms than people had hoped, and really aggressively. And by the way, very publicly, a lot of what they did, they could have done quietly or covertly or without huge fanfare. Big question, why did they do it with such fanfare? Same reason totalitarian leaders do these things, because they have their own internal home fears. They've just finished the CCP Congress, the People's Congress in China, which is their big get-together of all the party. Just finished it like a few days ago. And they announced that Hong Kong National Security Act at the opening of the party session, right? Because all eyes were on the leaders. What do you got for me now? And they said, first of all, they wanted to take the risk of Hong Kong not becoming part of China with as much as tight a bind as they want. They wanted to get rid of that. She wanted to get that risk off the table. And they wanted to show their people, you know, throw a little gasoline on a red blood issue, to mix a bunch of metaphors there. Like, the people in China really care about reuniting with Hong Kong. But again, some of the leading Hong Kong moderates and whatever, kind of like, yeah, they're not that shocked by it. But around the world, there's a lot of shock because they were so assertive about it. And if you're Trump, it's great news because it plays very much into his narrative of China being an enemy, China running the tables on us, us needing to rebalance the tables, him being, quote unquote, not true, the first president to really address this. Isn't he great? And so this is good for him. He already is very anti-China. He used to call the coronavirus the China virus, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, that's a big piece of news.
So basically, I'm going to use bad analogies, but you know, Hong Kong was sort of this Western-like city-state through the 90s, and then it became sort of the back to the possession of China, and then China said, okay, we're going to sort of own this deal, but we're going to be China with a little dash of America thrown in there. And now they're saying no more America. Hong Kong is essentially China now, and that's the deal.
Yeah, I'd say that's a very rough way of looking at it. The handover of Hong Kong, remember, obviously, Hong Kong used to be a British colony, and it was a city-state. It was like the classic city-state. It was an extraordinarily successful region. It was Britain's last substantial overseas territory. In 97, they handed it over to China, quote unquote, and there was supposed to be this process to kind of ease into it. And China, a week ago or so, said, you know, enough of easing into it. We're just, boom, like we're just dropping the hammer.
Yeah.
Okay, so to George Floyd, this is the one where, well, I mean, the others too, I don't want to make light of them, but this is the one where I just can't keep up. There's so many changes going on so quickly, and some of them are so profound. Some of them are very symbolic, I want to be clear, but I would argue they're also quite powerful. And for me, I think if you're about my age, and my guess is if you're a bit older than me, which is to say, I don't know, if you're somebody who is sort of aware of things in the 60s, this is like the biggest thing that's happened since the 60s, from an historical perspective. And certainly in my lifetime, I didn't really become conscious of politics and say until 1976 or something. And so since then, for me, this is one of a kind. And it's happening at a rate that's really interesting to me and frankly, very hopeful to me.
It's a good question. You know, since Vietnam, what have been the most major news stories? It'll probably, if you measured it somehow, and there's ways to measure it, it probably will be, we'll see what ends up happening with the George Floyd protests, whatever this moment is called. We don't even know yet what it's called. We'll see what it's called. If it continues, gets, you know, more anything, then my theory here will change. But I'd say the biggest news items in American history, sort of since Vietnam, probably are Corona, then 9/11, and all of that, the invasion of Iraq and that whole thing. But Corona is probably a bigger news story. I mean, hard to say. And the George Floyd protests. But we have two of them happening, boom, right next to each other, and one because, to some extent, because of the other. So this is a unbelievably, and look, it's a horrible thing that happened. It's a horrible thing that continues to happen. It's a horrible thing that's happened in America since the original stain of slavery on our country. But it's also a beautiful thing that's happening in a lot of ways now too. And if you recall, throughout this week and then a lot before the protests started, I was very bearish. I think it's a phrase I used. I was really concerned about the capital versus labor element in America, how Corona was laying bare a lot of what looked like a hoax on the working people in America. Like that thing was obvious to me. We ran social unrest meters at Ergo that were highly accurate. They didn't pick up on George Floyd getting murdered, obviously, but since then they've been off. They literally don't work because there's so much social unrest. So, you know, I had indications and historical indications that pandemics lead to unrest. We knew this in the 1919 Seattle labor riots. There were labor riots in Seattle. There really were labor riots throughout the whole country after Spanish flu. So this is, you know, history is a precedent here. So I was very bearish, and you might remember I was sort of down in the mouth about the American experiment even before the Floyd killing and protests. And then the beginning of this week, I was really, really questioning. I think you and I both were. I was very much questioning if the experiment and an American greatness, as I just said previously, was actually, it's just been a perpetuation of a hoax by the royals over the serfs, the perpetuation of that reality, you know, centuries old. I don't feel as pessimistic today. I feel more optimistic. And it is probably because of some of the counter I'm going to say counteroffensive, but I want to not use words of warfare. So let's say some of the countermanding forces that we've seen against Trump and others in the last week, right? Like President Bush, President Obama, General Mattis, the two senators, Murkowski and Collins, who always give, they always give lip service to protesting Trump. They never follow through on it. Romney always does follow through and give lip service. So the ones you'd expect have stood up and sort of made the right comments. But the Mattis comment and a lot of others really restores my hope in what we can do here.
So a week ago today, you and I on the program, I was ranting about when the looting starts, the shooting starts. So that was a week ago today. And, you know, there's been a bunch of other things that have happened in that regard. But I think it was a powerful turning point where the opposition to that kind of thinking made itself known and loud, and probably in part led to Mattis, et cetera, what happened in the next week. But how might you, this is pressure, how might you sort of look at what are the milestones? Like, how do you look at a week of milestones?
Friday 29th, massive protest. It became a nationwide phenomena. Right around there, Trump does looting starts, shooting starts. So he sets the table, right? The protesters take fuel from his tweet. He has yet to learn this, that when he tweets things like this, it actually doesn't just hurt him with sensible people saying that's appalling. It gives fuel to his enemies. And I don't know when he did that tweet. It was about Thursday, Friday.
I think it was Friday morning. And when did he go to the church? Was that Saturday?
No, that was much more recent than that.
Was that this
week?
I'm so
confused. Tuesday, Monday, Tuesday? That was Monday, maybe.
Monday.
That was after a weekend of protests that led all the way to his front yard and forced him to briefly retreat to the bunker beneath the White House, President Trump arrived in the Oval Office on Monday, agitated over the television images, annoyed that anyone would think he was hiding, and he was eager for action. So that was Monday is when he pulled that. So Monday will be looked at as, if Trump loses, Monday will be seen, I think, as people will go back and argue that's when he lost some moderate voters because of what he did in Lafayette Square on Monday.
Moderate right-wing voters.
Well, moderate, you know, whatever you call the 300,000 swing voters that voted for Trump. 300,000 voters actually was less than that. It's about 80 to 100,000 voters delivered Trump the Electoral College victory in the last presidential election. The RNC is very keen on keeping those voters plus maybe twice as many, 300,000 voters in eight states. They think if those voters come to their side, then they will win again. And I suspect they're right because their machine is awesome. They really are very, very good at knowing who they need to have come on board to win. And those people are swing voters because they're, you know, whatever you call them, right-wing, moderate, whatever. They're not the people who looked at the photo of Trump at the church and said, that's my guy. They're not the folks who looked at when the looting starts, the shooting starts, and said, I'm with you, Prez. They're the folks who went, oh, man, I'm not sure I've signed up for that. They actually, interestingly, who those people are, a lot of them would also be Sanders voters. They're not, it's not so much that they're right-wing, left-wing. They're for change, and they feel like the system is rigged against them. Different conversation, but really relevant. And that gets this point of those voters, to quote a, you know, a really brilliant Republican strategist said to me a couple times, those voters decided to vote the biggest middle finger they could to the system, and that was Donald Trump. So those folks have to stay with him. And they are the kind of people, as is, for example, some people in my family who are very conservative and very Christian, who have been with Trump up until this week. They've been on and off. They know to kind of fib to me about it because I really lose my steam with them. But this week, one of them said, all right, you know what? Just so you know, I am definitely not voting for this guy anymore. And it was the Bible moment, right? So it was that Monday moment at Lafayette Square. That's going to be a big piece of news. If Trump loses, they'll say that's what that was, like the tipping point of it happening. For people in the military, It was repugnant for General Mattis, President Trump's Secretary of Defense. It was repugnant. Why? What's the big deal? Well, let's remind ourselves. The First Amendment of the Constitution guarantees your right to protest. It's a huge deal. It separates us from, you know, any non-democracy. It's a lot of democracies where you can't protest as freely as you can in ours. You know, you're not allowed to go and protest in Germany and wear a Nazi sign or do the Heil Hitler salute in Germany. America, you can. You look like an evil piece of shit, but you're allowed to do it. So in that's the time I can curse, right? So we had peaceful protesters in Lafayette Square. By the way, those of you who've done your eighth grade trip to D.C. or been there, Lafayette Square is a place of continual protest. There's a nuclear, an anti-nuclear war protester across Pennsylvania Avenue, across from the White House, who's been there since before I was born. And when I worked at the White House, I used to go talk to him. And last time I was down at the White House a few months ago, I went and talked to him. He lives in a tent in permanent protest across the White House protesting nuclear weapons. That's what Lafayette Square is. In fact, if there's a place in America that's where the people protest legally, that's it. So President Trump goes to the bunker on Monday, which we can talk about because I've been in that bunker. And then he says, I've had enough. And he kind of quietly gets some people together and turning Attorney General Barr and says, clear the protesters, here we go. And they use, it's still not clear if it was tear gas or not. It was quote unquote some chemical substance. And they, federal officers, clear the protesters out violently. Some are injured. Clergy people are injured. Doctors and nurses are injured to clear out Lafayette Square so the president can stride across Pennsylvania Avenue and take that goofy photo of him holding the Bible upside down and sideways. Doesn't say a word. Takes the photo op, you know, pulls it out of his daughter's $1,500 handbag, takes the photo, and walks back. No big deal. I go, okay, fine. So whatever. Guy takes a photo op. Huge deal, because he used the federal forces to violate the First Amendment, and he had a in-uniform chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff walking with him. That will be a stain on that man's life forever. I was talking to a senior military officer this morning who is in uniform. Obviously, he won't say who he is. An extraordinary patriot, far right-wing, or let's say right-wing. And we're talking about other things, and I said, oh, well, you know, I think the chairman's name is Millie. You can't blame the chairman. Like, what's all this stuff's going on in real time? How's he supposed to know? He serves the president. He serves the Constitution, but he serves the president. So he's walking with the president. You know, you can't blame him. And this officer says, you can't blame the chairman of Joint Chiefs for not knowing what's appropriate use of American force or not. You can't blame the chairman of Joint Chiefs for not understanding the U.S. Constitution. Who are you supposed to blame for not understanding that in the moment? That's the guy who's supposed to know. I was like, yeah, that's a good point. You know, he's supposed to be the one who gets it right. He didn't. So that's Monday.
you know, I spoke to a guy named Larry Gordon, who's a movie producer. He's made a bunch of big movies, Die Hard and Field of Dreams. I mean, tons of movies. And he said to me, you know, he says, Tom, if you brought me that script, right, of what Trump did, he's like, no way we're making that movie. That's the stupidest script you could ever, right? It's a joke. Like what that whole thing was. It's amazing. It's really amazing. I mean, it shows you a little, well.
Well, so much of what's happening is you can't write this stuff.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, look, The Simpsons X number of years ago made a huge joke about Donald Trump being president, right? Like, because it was so farcical.
Yeah.
And just remember, if you recalibrate your what's acceptable meter, whatever you want to call that, you go back to any president before this one, and you take any one of literally the 25 most offensive things the president has done, and you were to transport that back in time and have Obama or Bush or Reagan or Nixon or Clinton do it, they would be in huge trouble. There's a big difference. Obviously, the Clinton-Lewinsky thing kind of stands up as another misbehavior. But I'm talking about the anti-constitutional behaviors and words and utterances. You know. Anyway, so that's Monday. Tuesday, he starts having real trouble with the military. And President Bush issues his letter, which was beautiful. President Bush and Laura.
So that was Tuesday?
That was Tuesday, the 2nd. And then, now here's another thing that's quite interesting. If you're in the military, so if you're like a if you're a Patriots fan, you're very aware of where Tom Brady is and who, what's going on with him and what's life like. Because he's like one of the shining jewels of your team, right? If you're in the military, you're, of course, Brady's not there anymore, but you get my point. If you're in the military, you're very aware of the shining jewels in the military. So Army, Air Force, Navy, Marines, whatever branch you're in, you're still very aware of the 82nd Airborne, the 101st Airborne, Marine Force Recon, the Delta Force, you know, these superstar Hall of Famers that are in your on your team, right? So the military is very aware of, like, you know, where's the Teddy Roosevelt carrier battle group? Everyone in the Navy knows where it is because they know where all their star players are. The 82nd Airborne deployed to Washington, D.C. this week, right? And everyone in the military knows that. 82nd Airborne, one of our more storied combat paratrooping groups, deployed to our nation's capital. I'm like, wow, that's a big deal. The president was afraid of his own people, his own citizens, and had to go into his emergency bunker. That happened this week. So President Bush's letter on the 2nd, on the 3rd, President Trump's Secretary of Defense, former four-star Admiral Mattis, four-star General Mattis, releases his letter, which is as damning a letter from a cabinet member to his president, former cabinet member to his president, as I've ever seen. We went over that a lot yesterday. Thursday, George Floyd funeral, massive protests around the country. Rioting and looting appears to go way down. And here we are Friday, and we get our jobs report. That a ton of jobs are coming back online. 13% unemployment versus 2025. So that's a big deal. It's quite a week.
Yeah. It's amazing. And it's I would describe it, this is my, the momentum towards a desired improved culture through the moment as defined by George Floyd seems to be on display. Like, that to me is the big story. There's some bad stories that surround it, you know, some people saying some wacky things or some things that are less than loving, or I would argue certainly that they are. I've been in a whole variety of environments this week where I would struggle to find anyone who didn't have this sense of, I want to be part of a better country. Now, I'm sure there are places where that's not true, but the preponderance of communication has seemed to suggest that, and some of it is informal, but some of it is very formal. I mean, George Bush's letter is formal. Mattis's letter is formal. You know, John Kelly, through conversation, spoke in support, and you're talking about his chief of staff.
By the way, again, you were saying you couldn't keep up the headlines. What did Kelly say?
Kelly said
another four-star Marine.
Yeah, he agrees with the contents of Mattis's letter. He said it at the SALT conference online, talking to Anthony Scaramucci. That's, you know, chief of staff. It's a big job. That's a guy who was sort of
the biggest, right? The biggest jobs, bigger than the vice president. The number one job administration is the chief of staff.
Yeah.
The chief of staff tells the vice president what to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Certainly all the cabinet members. So really, we had the president's chief of staff, secretary of defense say this. Tillerson, secretary of state, certainly feels this. He's the one who was quoted as saying the president is, and he had a bunch of derogatory terms to the president previously. I wonder where he is.
So that part of the revolution, I'm just going to use that term. I know that's a strong term. The spectrum might be wide, but, you know, before we show this clip, I'm going to admit something to you, which is, and I don't want to get into a debate about it, really. I just want to make an observation that I don't want anyone to get hurt, okay? I don't want anyone to get hurt. And I don't want to be flippant or blasé about COVID either. But I feel very strongly about the protests, and again, I want people to stay safe. I don't want them getting hurt in the middle of these protests. But I'm not somebody who's gonna spend a lot of time talking about a line between looting and protesting. That's me. And I just mentioned that because historically I probably would have been.
This is a big one. Let me respond to that for you on the video. First Amendment right, beautiful thing, people protesting. It's like, it's one of the greatest things in America. It's even greater when they're doing it at the risk of catching a deadly disease, you know, deadly for some, right? I mean, this is a gorgeous thing. And literally, if people were protesting for something I disagreed with, I would find it gorgeous. I think it's awesome when Americans do this. You said there's sustained, I'm flipping your words around a little bit, but you feel like there's sustained momentum for an improved culture in America. And I feel that too. And I want to talk about concrete change, but let me go back to this. There's this momentum for an improved culture. There are young multiracial people, all ages, out there protesting peacefully, doing what our Constitution enshrines and our hearts embrace, and it's awesome. And When it bleeds, it leads. So what do you see on TV? What do you read in the papers? Well, you see, in some instances, certainly in the TV, stories of violence. There are stories of continued police violence on protesters. There was one in Buffalo where they pushed an old man over. It's appalling. 70-year-old man, they pushed him over, cracked his head open. But then there's also lots of videos of looters and rioters. And so a little different than you, Tom, I think it's got to stop because of two things. It's hurting people, destroying their personal property.
You're talking about looting.
I'm talking about looting, just to be explicit. I'm talking about looting and protest, looting and rioting. So A, you know, look, it's against the law. Stop it. You have no right to do it. I don't sign up for anything about like, let them burn off their pent frustrations. No, like you're not allowed to destroy someone's store and hurt people. Like that's not acceptable. But a really, really big second aspect of this is it's just hurts the entire narrative of what's going on here because when it bleeds, it leads, right? So the story a lot of Americans have isn't of these beautiful, important protests and the message they're carrying for a sustained momentum for an improved culture, again, using your words. It's of, oh, there's a bunch of, you know, young hooligans out there looting and rioting. Well, no, there really aren't. There's 10,000 arrests. Millions and millions and millions of people protesting. So the ratios are, you know, well under 0.01% of people. But it destroys the story, I think.
I understand. And I would normally, I just can't explain it. I know. I'm just saying personally, like it's so ranked far down for me.
Yeah. No, it is for me too. And I think one thing we talked about the other day was temperance, right? Like, it's a moment where everyone doesn't have to hear everyone's opinion, by the way, right now, right? I think it's okay for clickbait firebrands on the far left or far right just to shut up for a second, right? I don't need to hear what Ann Coulter's view or whoever the far left equivalent is. I'm sorry, I don't know. It'd be more fair if I did. I don't really need to hear their point of view right now. Because those are divisive points of view.
Yeah.
And so for those of us who parrot their points of view, so that's their job. They get paid for it. They really probably believe they have a role. You know, I don't. And again, I completely support the right to say it. But for those of us, it's not our job. I think we have to have more temperance. So I think maybe that's part of what you're referring to as well.
I'm being far more philosophical than I am pragmatic. And it has to just do with the way I feel. And, you know, I'm not typically like that. I tend to like have my emotion and then try to get my P's and Q's in order. And now I'm like, I'm okay with my emotion playing a leading role because I feel this sense of a certain amount of frustration tied to a certain amount of hope, but recognize, I guess this is what it is for me. You know, when Stacy said put people first when we were in St. Louis or when I was in St. Louis, I want to take that literally. I want to be literal about, here's the thing, I'm a version of a libertarian, but I'm more of somebody who believes in the power of a democracy with a good constitution than I am even a capitalist. And the power of a democracy is about honor and respect of other people first and foremost. And yeah, I would argue it's best combined with a capitalist culture, which I'm for, but I still rank it below. And so at the moment, I'm just sort of having this human moment of, I want to try to be part of a human moment and an opportunity. I'm sorry, I repeat that. Then I do the rest. And so that's all. It's just a mindset, I guess.
I think you and I are largely aligned. So
let me show this video. So that's a street in Washington, D.C. Now, what we don't have... Oh, you know what? I just figured out where that is. I couldn't figure out where that is. That's right in front of the Hay Adams Hotel. And that's St. John's Church right there.
Yeah, and that's going right to Lafayette Park. Yeah.
Okay, I was turned around. So, and they renamed it Black Lives Matter Square. Is that right? I'm not talking about the protesters. I'm talking about the city of Washington. I don't want to get this wrong, because it might be the street, it might be the square. I don't know what it is, but they've renamed it, and they've put those words in the street that leads into Lafayette Square. Lafayette Square is the park that sits in front of the White House, and that is official government business of the city of Washington, D.C. And if you, as Dan pointed out earlier, the city of Washington, you know, the citizens of Washington don't participate in the selection of the President of the United States. Oh, no. Well, they know they do in the President of the United States, but they don't have representation in the House and the Senate. But they get to vote in the presidential election, don't they?
I don't think that there's electors from Washington, D.C., are there? Maybe there are, but they certainly, they have a rep, but she doesn't get a vote in the House of Representatives. Right. She's, you know, watches like Puerto Rico.
But they
get fully taxed. So remember, the license plate says taxation without representation.
Yeah.
And they put it on the... They try to put it on Bush 43's limousine. That's where it first, you know, because he had to register his car in D.C. So they put taxation without representation on his limousine.
Yeah. Anyway, I just find this so, you know, it's so potent. The symbolism is so powerful. And, you know, the symbolism between the kneeling, the Black Lives Matter in the road, the symbolism of the Bible being held in front of St. John's. It's like there's a massive gulf between the first two and the latter, but very symbolic and very historic. And I don't know, there's even something about the color yellow there. It's very celebratory, and it's something. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's a peaceful color too, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not red. It's not violent.
Yeah. You know, I remember when they first showed the scenes of the tanks coming into Baghdad. Remember the military leader from Iraq was like, oh, the Americans aren't anywhere. And then, you know, and then a split screen, the tanks are in the middle of Baghdad.
Yeah.
And in some ways. Yeah. And then in some ways, it's like when you write Black Lives Matter right there, I'm like, wow, there it is, man. It's just a more beautiful image and a powerful moment.
So one thing that you and I have circled around a bit on is, so that is very compelling to you. And then I fall back on what, you know, your producer Dan was saying earlier, that, yeah, and then DC still gets the short end of the stick, right? So it's like, you know, it's like they can write whatever they want on the street, you know. So what we talked about, the way I was able to find some comfort, some rope in my conversation with Neil, where I felt just so out of my depth, was about concrete change and what kind of concrete change can we have. And so back to your point about sustained momentum for improved culture, I'm really excited to see what the concrete changes will be. And again, as a government guy, I'm looking for something, right? So, and I don't know what, I mean, there's not even enough. There's not enough really concrete suggestions out there from my taste on let's change this, let's change that with legislation or law. Culture, yeah. But back to the capriciousness of the news cycle, I don't know how long the cultural shift will hold. I hope it does, you know. So that's this cycle where I feel urgency to take advantage of this moment. This moment of shared culture and shared circle of empathy. Like we've expanded our circle of empathy a bit, maybe in the country, right? Where a lot of us are beginning to see each other with softer eyes than we had previously. We're beginning to understand more the plight of African Americans, and via Corona, we're beginning to understand more perhaps the plight of labor. You know, capital C labor, ideally more softly. I mean, that's optimistic, but I think there's some reason to think that's right. Now, to be fair, the other thing's probably happening too, where people on the far right who are racist are probably getting more ingrained in their racism by looking at rioters and looters versus protesters. And I put those on podcasts, I put big air quotes over rioters and looters.
You know, the thing I think about in that regard, and so, yes, definitely. And I've seen a couple examples of it this week that really upset me. And they're people I know, by the way, and it really upset me. You know, in some part, well, before I say that, let me say this. The thing that I've thought a lot about this week, and Simon Greer, you may know Simon, but Simon's sort of done this work between Israelis and Palestinians and a whole variety of like oppositional relationships over the years. He knows his stuff is the bottom line. And I the one thing is, you know, when you start to feel that fear, I think it's really important to pay attention to it. And when I say that fear of, am I going to say the wrong thing? And where do I belong? And what?
Right.
I think, so A, actively listen for sure. And B, try to go into that fear a little bit. And if I have a hope, it's that it is okay if white people talk to white people about this in an open way, because I think that's part of the solution too, right? And so the opportunities are just so vast. Now, as you said, listening to Neil and listening to others who aren't us is so meaningful. But here's my challenge for my team. My general sense is that there's so many things that so many parts of America don't know about the other parts of America. And what we're talking about is storytelling.
Yeah.
Can my organization and others like ours tell stories more effectively so that people, the empathy becomes obvious? And I say that I'm upset and angry at some of the things I saw from people I know. And then I have this moment where I think they're kind of clueless. Now listen to me as if I know everything. But I do think I've observed things that if they observed them, I don't think they would have written those things. And then I think, well, maybe I can help them observe those things. So, a thought.
Yeah, it was one of our listeners, somewhere on social media I think it was a man, he and I were in a chat. I'm sorry, I don't remember his name right now. And I was commenting on something correlated to what you were saying more about vaccine deniers. And he said, remember, they have to want to learn the truth as well. And maybe the right stories can get people in that mindset. You can't be facts, right? It has to be narratives. And that's why your work and your movies, you know, I mean, one, those of us who've had the privilege of watching your movies, particularly when you do the neighborhood thing where you show the film, then you show the folks watching it, like Chief Monahan's group, where, you know, you have these really hard men together in New Hampshire sitting in a room. They're all cops and former cops. And they watch Forgiveness, one of your great movies, and then how they all become very human and soft. Like, if you didn't have the transportation of the movie, you would never have gotten them there to the point. Let's say theoretically, let's say it helps to get them to the point of really wanting to learn and open up and expand their circle of empathy and understanding. So storytelling is the thing, Tom. I couldn't agree with you more. Storytelling and build bigger neighborhoods, right? Storytelling and build bigger neighborhoods that become a web across the country